What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to another week of Call to Communion here on EWTN, the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith that's maybe been bothering you, it's rolling around in your head for a while, maybe even for years, who knows, do give us a call. Let's get that question answered for you. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 3986. If you're listening to us outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And you can also send us an email if you prefer that, ctc@EWTN.com is the address, ctc@EWTN.com. All right, Charles Beery is our producer. We also have Ryan Penny standing by to take your phone call. And Jeff Burson is on social media. He'll be glad to pass on any questions you may want to pose via YouTube or Facebook. Just put those in the comments field, and he'll pass those on to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Very well. How was your weekend, my friend?
Oh, it was fair to middling.
That's a good thing. We spent part of the weekend, I mean, we had a rainy Saturday here in Alabama. But we spent yesterday with the Brazilian Franciscans, a bunch of friars, out playing volleyball
where they play?
Oak Mountain.
That's right.
Yeah.
What's a little bracing dampness to a couple of Franciscan Brazilians, huh?
Oh, it was fun. It was so much fun. We had a blast. So we're going to lead off here with some very interesting emails. This one particularly caught my eye. This is from Ricky. Ricky says, I am struggling with all the saints who give private revelations on hell. It seems so legalistic and bizarre that it's making me want to become Eastern Orthodox. Can you help? Thanks, Ricky.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first of all, I should say, you ought to really poke into Eastern Orthodoxy's more bizarre views about the afterlife and private revelations on their side, because if that's a motive for you to consider Orthodoxy, I mean, look, the Orthodox are great. I mean, no problem with the Orthodox. But they got their share of weird private revelations and strange beliefs on the afterlife.
Okay?
And I'll just
all
say
right.
No more. Look, this is not part of the public teaching of the Catholic Church.
Mm.
I mean, that's the long and the short of it. When you become Catholic, you do not affirm belief in the veracity or validity of any private revelation. None whatsoever. And, I mean, if you encounter some alleged private revelation, and you, even one that's approved, and you think that there's good rational grounds for thinking that maybe that's a little bit of hogwash, you're within your right to consider it hogwash to a certain extent,
oh.
Right? I mean, you do so with kind of pious sensitivity to the faithful and
yeah.
the role that this plays in people's devotional life and so forth and the respect that others may have held for it, but you're certainly not obligated to believe it.
Okay. Oh, very good.
And in fact, any revelation that at face value seems to contradict the public teaching of the church is to be rejected right out of hand or really, really strongly reinterpreted in a way that's consistent with the tradition.
All right. Very good. Ricky, thank you so much for your email. Just got a text from, of all people, my wife, Adrienne, who says, don't forget to mention that the Brazilian Franciscan nuns were also out there playing volleyball. So equal time, David.
Okay. Well, were they playing mixed? I mean, guys and girls on the same team, or was it guys against girls?
I don't know. It looked like a pickup game to me. I think they were all having fun,
and that's
the main thing.
There you go.
Here's an email from Michael who says, Dr. Anders, I live in Massachusetts, been listening to you since the beginning of your show, and I have a simple question. I hope it's simple. I grew up in a Lutheran family, but when I went to college, I fell away from my faith. That was 37 years ago. I've never returned. I would like to start reading the Bible again, but I don't know where to begin. Any guidance would be greatly appreciated. God bless you and your show. Michael.
Yeah, Michael, how about starting with the Gospels?
That's
how about starting with the Gospels?
Great place.
St. Dominic supposedly carried a copy of the Gospel of St. Matthew with him in his back pocket. And, I mean, he read the rest of the Bible, too. But, I mean, he got a lot of mileage out of that one Gospel, right? You know, and I'm with St. Dominic on this. But I like all the Gospels. I'm a big fan of John. But man, I tell you what, you can get a lot of work done with Matthew. Because, of course, that's where you find the clearest statement up front of the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, which is really kind of the Magna Carta of Christian life and spirituality. I mean, you could, for that matter, you could just stick with those three chapters for a while, Matthew 5 to 8. You spend a year just on those.
Yeah.
That'd be worse things you could do with your time.
Sure. Okay. Well, there you go, Michael. I hope that works well for you. Dimitri checked in with an email who says, an Anglican chaplain that I know offers oil on the hands of workers in a nearby hospital. Well, for a Catholic, is participation a matter of prudential judgment, or is there any church law regarding this? Thanks, Dimitri.
Okay, thanks. So, yeah, I would tend to stay away from oily Anglicans. I really would. Okay.
When you put it like that, gee.
You know, and first of all, I assume that this particular Anglican individual is not purporting that this is an instance of the sacrament of holy anointing, which, of course, would be absolutely illicit for you to participate in. You cannot take the putative sacraments of non-Catholic churches. That'd be right out.
Yeah.
Probably this is, he conceived of this is more of a kind of sacramental. But even then, I think you're really outside the sort of the ethos of Catholic theology on the sacramentals, because the sacramentals have the efficacy that they have through the jurisdiction and jurisdiction of the church and of the priest that makes the blessing. And in this instance, the Anglican clergyman does not have any jurisdiction from the church to authentically bless sacramentals and bring them within the orbit of the church's intercessory powers. So, look, there are rites and signs and symbols of other tradition that imitate to a certain extent the Catholic sacraments without possessing their intrinsic efficacy or power. And those rites and symbols can be, for participants in those tradition, signs of transcendence and modes of engaging God in an unseen and unknown way. And so, you know, I'm not going to put those down within the context of his tradition, but as a Catholic, you have a better way. And so let's take the better way.
Sounds good to me. Dimitri, thank you so much for your email. In a moment here, we're going to get to some phone calls, including Lori in Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. We've got a line or two open for you right now. Actually, three lines available at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for the Monday afternoon edition of Call to Communion. Hey, if you don't want to be bombarded by fake news, I recommend EWTN's National Catholic Register. It's America's most trusted Catholic news source with a comprehensive view of the world from a distinctly Catholic perspective. And I'll tell you what, that trustworthiness is earned every day by the good people at the Register. Give it as a gift or subscribe for yourself. Visit ncregister.com. That's ncregister.com. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with Lori in Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio, a first-time caller. Hello, Lori. What's on your mind today?
Hello. My husband and I have been married for 2 years secularly. I was raised Mormon, and he has not been baptized in any church. And we started RCIA a year ago. And we both have prior marriages to take care of. I have one, and he has two. And he mentioned the other day that if we continue to live as husband and wife, we're living in sin. And so I told him I want a second opinion. And I'm wondering, does the Pauline privilege help us in this matter?
Thank you. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, you having been raised Mormon and your husband having raised unbaptized, neither one of you was validly baptized, and therefore there's no chance that either one of you could have previously obtained a sacramental marriage, and your present relationship is definitely not sacramental under any other, however we slice it. However, it is possible that one of you did succeed in realizing a natural marriage. And unless you left the former spouse because of conversion to Christianity, the Pauline privilege really doesn't obtain. However, I think given your situation, it is going to be falling off a log easy to obtain an annulment, because it is it's just extraordinarily, exceedingly unlikely that either one of you sought to obtain what the Catholic Church means by a natural marriage. And I think, just think it's not going to be a problem at all. I mean, in terms of how you conduct yourselves between now and the time you you obtain that annulment and what practices you should follow, I really want to direct you to your priest and to the spiritual direction you receive, as he helps you through this process. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it'll be difficult at all.
There you go. Lori, thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Looks like three lines open right now. Couple our screen. So we're waiting to hear from you. 833-288-EWTN. Mayella is listening to us on Facebook today. Mayella says, my daughter, who used to be Catholic when younger, now claims to be an agnostic, and she says that Jesus was born in April. Any information that you can share so I can research and respond? And does the exact date really matter? Thanks, Mayella.
Okay, thanks. So I am struggling to understand why the date of Jesus' birth has anything to do with whether or not there's a God.
Yeah.
I don't see that there's any relevance whatsoever. I mean, Jesus could have been born any out of the 365 and one quarter days possible in the calendar,
mm-hmm.
or not. And it would have no impact on the question of whether or not the universe has an intelligible and intelligent first cause.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a God long before Jesus was born.
That's true.
Right? There's always been a God. Right?
So, yeah.
And the date of Christ's birth just doesn't come into the philosophical argument for God's existence. Nor does it really enter into the trustworthiness of divine revelation, because to the best of my knowledge, the church has never proclaimed infallibly and as a dogma that Christ was born on December the 25th. I mean, this is the liturgical date of our church's celebration. And some of the church fathers held that opinion that this was the date of Christ's birth. And eventually, when the feast of Christmas began to be regularly celebrated east and west, they had to settle on some day,
mm-hmm.
because, doing things together is part of what it means to be Catholic.
Sure.
We kind of want to practice the faith in one way around the world so that, you don't walk into one Catholic church in one country and get one thing and another church in another country and get something else entirely.
Right.
Be in unity in the faith. So you have to pick one day to do it. And there was a tradition about that, from Hippolytus, but I'm not aware that it was ever declared to be a dogma. It's certainly not revealed in sacred scripture as something that God formally revealed, So, I just don't think this is an odd reason to reject the faith.
Mm-hmm. Mayella, thank you so much for your call. We hope that's helpful. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here's Valerie in New Orleans listening on Catholic Community Radio. Hi, Valerie. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I think I'll just come out there with the main point of my question is, what do we hold higher up in regards to, as Catholics, what we need to seriously consider with teaching and morals? Official documents that are in the Vatican or, pronounced by the Holy See, or, when the Pope is talking, I guess, or giving, a homily or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that question. So, beyond a shadow of a doubt, what priests, popes, and bishops say off the cuff in homilies or radio interviews or whatever it might be, is certainly not protected by the charism of infallibility, certainly not, and in no way should be regarded as definitive or authoritative in a profound sense for Catholics. Now, there's a lesser sense in which these kind of pronouncements are authoritative, and let me explain it with reference to your parish church where this is most evident. Let's say Father gets up and preaches just a really awful homily. Just a terrible humdinger of a homily, all right? It would be entirely inappropriate for you to stand up in Mass and go, boo, ooh, that was an awful homily, right? There is a kind of priority that he possesses. He presides over the liturgy and has a place of authority in the church. And decency and order and propriety require us, for the sake of the common good and tender consciences and our own children and the good opinion of our neighbors and things like that, not to stand up and boo a bad homily, right? Although I did hear a story from Jimmy Akin one time, all right, yeah, which I might share briefly. He heard just an awful homily that contained some Christological heresy.
Uh-oh.
About the homilist had actually asserted that Jesus didn't know he was God, which of course is false.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Mr. Akin strongly desired to stand up and say boo boo, but he didn't. he restrained himself. And then heard this on Catholic Answers, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And then it was one of those masses where they gave the faithful, the laity, the opportunity to speak aloud during the intercessions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we pray for my Edna's bad knee. We
sure
all pray the Lord hear our prayer. This kind of business. When it came to Akin's turn, he stood up and said, "And we give thanks to God that Jesus always knew he was divine."
Ooh. He got it in there.
He got it in there.
That's good.
So there's a kind of authority, but it's the kind that requires a kind of deference and respect due to the position because of that, but to the person because of that person's position or office, but doesn't require us to hold that what they've said is anything other than ludicrous, if it is in fact ludicrous.
Uh-huh.
And look, popes and bishops and priests have done and said, even operating in an official capacity, they've done ludicrous things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Code of Canon Law actually includes the provision that the faithful have a right and sometimes a duty, in a respectful, decent way, not yelling boo at a homily,
right,
to say, that was really off. And so, you know, for example, something else Mr. Akin could have done in that situation, maybe he did, is write a nice little note to the priest afterwards, or maybe send somebody to send a note to the bishop if it was really bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this kind of thing. Just say, hey, do you know this being taught over here? We need to kind of clean this up.
Yeah.
And there have been instances in papal history when theologians, cardinals, bishops, and even the lay faithful have said to the Holy Father, that was kind of off base. And classic example would be the pontificate of John the 22nd, who famously held that the souls of the just do not see God when they die. Well, the common opinion of the saints and of the fathers was that they did, right? That they could be admitted to the beatific vision.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody knew that John the 22nd was kind of off base here. It hadn't been defined as a dogma yet, but he was really kind of cutting against the grain. And so lots of people called on Pope John the 22nd and said, we think that's kind of off base. And eventually, by the end of his life, he recanted that position. And then his successor, who was Benedict XII, actually published an encyclical, a bull, formally defining the dogma on the beatific vision, right? So Catherine of Siena would be a lay woman. She has like a Dominican Third Order, who also thought the Pope was kind of nuts when he was having fun and playing cards and shooting dice in Avignon instead of pastoring the church in Rome. So,
yes,
you know, she goes over to Avignon and says, Pope, let's pull it together and come on back to Rome where you belong. And he listened to her, and then he did. And he got really mad, and then he died in Rome, and they elected his successor.
So there you go. Valerie, hope that helpful. That is helpful for you. Thank you so much for your call. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Basil is listening to us in Nigeria today on YouTube. Basil says, my question is it possible for non-Catholic Christians to receive indulgences from the church?
Yeah, thank you. So a non-Catholic Christian cannot normally participate in the penitential discipline of the church, right? There are a very few exceptions. So, for example, let's say you have a Christian who's in danger of death.
Mm-hmm.
In danger of death, and they have Catholic faith in the sacraments. The church makes allowances in danger of death that it doesn't normally make, right?
Okay.
And part of the last rites of the church include the apostolic blessing, which is a plenary indulgence. So I actually haven't applied this question precisely this way, and I'm going to ask some priests who perform this sacrament and these rites regularly if I'm off base here, but if you allow that non-Catholic Christians can receive last rites in danger of death if they have Catholic faith in the sacraments, which would include an apostolic blessing, well, that's an indulgence. Then I would presume so, right, under that instance, all right? The question of whether or not indulgences could be applied to the dead that were known to be non-Catholic when they died, well, they were non-Catholic when they died.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But if they died in the state of grace, they're Catholic now.
Got it.
Right? They're Catholic now.
Sure.
That'd be the way I would reason that out.
All right. Basil, thanks for checking us out in Nigeria. Glad that you're listening today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Marie in Minnesota, listening on EWTN television, a first-time caller. Hey there, Marie. What's on your mind today?
I would like to know, when you're seeking Jesus, you're seeking God, because it's seek ye first, right? So when it says to come to a Catholic church or come to any church, where do you seek God first, and where do you seek the church second? Now, I know there's no difference between the two, and yet when you start talking about different things, you see Jesus in all these churches, and they have all different distinctions, but seeking Jesus first.
Okay, yeah, I really appreciate the question. So there's a number of ways to answer this, okay? One of them is that, as you know, God has made us in his likeness and image. And the principal way in which we are like God in his likeness and image is that we possess rationality. We have the faculty of reason and of free choice, which is why we have moral responsibility. And therefore, we have conscience. We have conscience to guide us. And so to begin with, you can rule out of consideration any flavor of Christianity, if you will, that teaches you to disregard the counsel of reason or of conscience. And you would say, well, who would do that? Well, believe it or not, lots. There are many, many versions of Christianity that discount the value of reason and of conscience. I won't enumerate them, lest I offend, but they're out there. They're out there, okay? So that's one principle right off the bat. Now, I might add that the Catholic Church has always taught that reason and conscience are, Cardinal Newman's words, the aboriginal vicar of Christ. They are testimonies to God's activity in our life from the very beginning, right? All right, so that's one test. Another one would be fidelity to the tradition given to us by Christ. So Jesus, when he founded the church, and he said he was going to found a church in Matthew 16, he said, Peter, on this rock I'll build my church. He gave the apostles the charge of handing on everything he had commanded them. Of course, that was nothing there was written down. That was all oral tradition and his example and ritual. And he commanded them to make disciples of all nations and teach all those things that he had commanded. And he promised that he would be with them until the end of the age. So that gives us another criterion that we can look at, namely, is there a Christian body out there that stands in direct historic continuity to the one founded by Jesus, and was not invented by men, but faithfully hands on the tradition that was given to the apostles 2,000 years ago, along with his promise of divine assistance. And, of course, Christ said the gates of hell would not prevail against that particular church. So it's one that's going to have remained in continuous existence for 2,000 years. Okay, so again, a Catholic church meets that criteria. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's the only name in town when you're talking about a church that's been around for 2,000 years in direct historic continuity with the one founded by Jesus. And that also teaches the primacy of reason and of conscience in the moral life. So looks to me like there's only one game in town.
Yeah, for sure. We do appreciate that. Thank you so much, Marie, for your call. Glad that you're watching us today on EWTN television. In a moment, we're going to get back to the phones and talk with Diane. Diane is in New York, and we'll also be hearing from Maurice, and Maurice is in Woodstock, Illinois. We've got a couple of people that are getting screened by Ryan right now. We're also going to get to a Facebook question or two, maybe a YouTube question, an email. We'll get it all in on this edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. And if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Back in a flash with lots more on the Monday edition of Call to Communion. The Monday afternoon edition of Call to Communion in progress here on EWTN. Looks like two lines open at the moment, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here is Diane in New York watching on EWTN television, a first-time caller. Hi, Diane. What's on your mind today?
I just want to say that I'm pro-life. And my friend called me today from a small church in in Gansfoot. And she said that they have an outside priest that comes in every week. He tells them who to vote for, and he has a sticker on his car. And most of them are pro-life, and it's been very upsetting. And I just would like to know what they can do besides calling the bishop. Is there anything else? Because it goes on. And it's also at another church that he appears. So it's a very disturbing situation.
And you were saying that he is preaching pro-life?
No, he's preaching pro-choice.
That's what I thought.
No, okay. He's preaching to vote for Biden.
Okay. Let's not say any names. Names.
Right.
Okay, all right. So, look, there are a lot of people on the ticket that hold various tickets, not just the two major political parties. They hold all kinds of ideas.
True.
So we're
yes.
not just differentiating between parties here at all or particular politicians. We don't endorse anybody.
Right.
And on that note, I might add that my own bishop, Stephen Reka, has told the clergy in our diocese, you're not to endorse any political candidate or party or even ideology. You're just to preach Catholic moral theology. And you let the faithful do the logical work of working out how those moral principles can best be accommodated to this or that ideology.
And this is what EWTN right? does as well.
Exactly. And that's, in my judgment, that is the thing we ought to do. Because, mm-hmm. look, when it comes to, it's one thing to say you shouldn't kill babies. I mean, you really shouldn't kill babies. It's very, very wrong to kill babies. You also should not, you shouldn't separate man and woman and child in family life from their foundational place in the structure of society. I mean, men and women together in matrimony are where babies come from and where they flourish best, and it's the foundation of culture. That's a major principle of Catholic moral thinking. The church and society ought to have a preferential option for the poor. Whatever you do, whatever economic policies you take or immigration policies, whatever, they shouldn't be constructed in such a way that the poor are disproportionately disadvantaged, mm-hmm. right, relative to whatever good is sought for the common weal. You really have to keep an eye out for the poor, preferential option for the poor, universal destination of goods. Like, this land is our land, from, I can't remember the rest of the hymn, right, from this side to that, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's our country. We got to cultivate it, intend it for the benefit of all, right, universal destination of goods. All of these things are Catholic moral principles. Now, how do you translate those into a platform and into a philosophy of government? Well, I mean, it's not that hard. You start with don't kill babies, for one,
yeah.
right? But it's not that. But some of the fine detail can definitely get you down into the realm of opinion about it. What's the best way to actually live this out in legislation? And the church really doesn't need to get down at that level of granularity, mm-hmm. Because now you start really getting, personalities involved and ideologies involved. And there, it is possible for people to hold the same moral principles and yet disagree on their interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And the danger of the church getting too deeply into ideology or political partisanship is that you start to define the contours of Catholic life more narrowly than Christ does. That's the difficulty. I mean, you can have two people in the same church that hold different opinions, on political policy, but be agreed on the fundamental moral principles, right? And so what this priest has done, or any priest who gets up there and preaches political ideology instead of Catholic moral theology, is he's saying, my way is the only way to interpret the church's patrimony. And yeah. so now, Jesus talked about this kind of attitude. He said, you guys go over land and sea to make a single convert, and then you put on him a burden that you yourselves could not lift, and you make him twice the son of hell he was before his conversion.
Yeah.
Right? This is why Jesus criticized Pharisaical religion, because they heaped up all of these requirements and ideological commitments mm-hmm. that went beyond the contours of the Word of God and a truly decent moral human life. And that, in my judgment, is what any priest does who imposes way too much of his own political ideology on the church's teaching. And that might be a way to approach it, is, you know, to approach the priest privately and say, Father, do you really think that your political opinions are the only legitimate way to interpret the church's moral teaching?
Mm-hmm.
And you're equating your political ideology with holiness? Really? Are you going to constrain the contours of the church and of moral decency that narrowly? That's the kind of guy you're going to be? Do you realize that you're offending, you know, two-thirds of your congregation by telling them they're deficient as Catholics because they don't think like you do politically?
Mm.
Do you really want to go there? Is that the kind of guy you want to be? Because he probably thinks himself as a broad-minded, liberal kind of guy, very tolerant and all that sort of thing. I mean, that's typically goes with the ideology, right? But there's a way of construing this, what you're really the narrow-minded bigot in this conversation.
Okay. Diane, thanks so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. Let's go to Maurice in Woodstock, Illinois, listening on WSFI 88.5 FM. Hey, Maurice, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You had a caller earlier that you mentioned something in natural marriage. I've been married to my wife for 44 years. I married her while I was away from the church. I was away from the church 35 years. I attempted to get her to church, or at least, you know, try to get her converted, I guess you might say. It's kind of hard. Are we married?
Okay.
In the eyes of the church?
Well, hang on. Let me back up and hear the situation again. You said you were raised Catholic.
Okay.
Your wife has not been practicing the Catholic faith. Where were you married again?
No, she was not. No. We've both been married together, monogamous marriage for 44 years.
And where did you, where were you married? Were you married in the Catholic Church?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, we were not. We were married by a judge.
And were you Catholic at the time of the marriage?
In name only.
Yeah, well, the church would not regard that as a valid marriage. Okay, they would not regard that as a valid marriage. However, the solution is very easy for you, right? Provided neither one of you has a previous marriage to worry about, all you have to do is have the relationship convalidated. I mean, and you can do that lickety-split. It'll take you one afternoon, and you're done. And this is actually my situation. My wife was raised Catholic, but married me outside the church. 10 years later, we figured out that we were not validly married in the eyes of the church. We just went to the priest, said our vows, convalidated the wedding, and, you know, boom, boom, there you go, sacramental marriage. So just go make an appointment with your priest and go get it convalidated, lickety-split.
There's a plan for you. Maurice, thank you so much for your call. Here is Ruth now. Ruth is in Sioux City, listening on Siouxland Catholic Radio. Hey, LaRuth, what's on your mind today?
I had hoped my daughter would maybe call it in because she would be more eloquently asking it, but I have a question that she said her biggest struggle. She grew up Catholic, all of our children did, but she's not attending currently. She attended a Christian university and met many very godly friends who have become pastors and ministers, and her biggest struggle with returning to the Catholic faith is the fact that women cannot be priests because she sees the witness of her, you know, dearest friends doing so much good. So I want to be able to answer that question. Dr. Anders has such an excellent way of addressing things and relating it to people, and she's almost 30, single, and literally just one of the best Christians that has been in my life. She's just a very godly woman, but really struggles with that.
Okay,
yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, I absolutely endorse and affirm your daughter's intuition that women can exceed men in holiness, virtue, fruitfulness of life in ways that are directly beneficial to the people of God and to society at large. 100% agree with that statement. And in fact, the church has always said this, has always said that women have a unique role to play as the church and as priests, according to the baptismal priesthood, witnesses for Christ who make him present in the world through their virtues, their graces, and their actions. You know, starting with the Blessed Virgin Mary, who, of course, is the most exalted creature of all, and has an absolutely unique, unrepeatable position of authority and preeminence in the Catholic faith. I mean, she is the mother of the Church. She is the mother of the Church. And her intercession is uniquely powerful, and her virtues to be uniquely imitated. And 2,000 years of Catholic women, and men for that matter, have been looking to her as a model of Christian spirituality. And this can take any number of manifestations, including leadership and administration and teaching, right, in various contexts. Prophetic witness. Earlier in the show, I mentioned Catherine of Siena, who was uniquely capable of telling the Pope off, right? I mean, can you imagine if one of the male cardinals had gone in and told the Pope off and that he needed to get back to Rome? Well, first of all, the cardinals wouldn't have done it because they were all his cousins and they were busy riding horses and hawking and playing dice, right? But Catherine of Siena, probably because she was a woman and because of her incredible holiness of life and her strength of character and witness, walked into the Pope and gave him what for, and he kind of, well, off he went, you know?
Mm.
And there was a celebrated American politician who will go unnamed on this show, who was well known for promoting abortion, and was once present at a meeting with Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And Mother Teresa absolutely took the guy to the woodshed verbally for his support of abortion. And the media gathered around and asked the fellow, well, what do you have to say about that? And brilliant politician with a great response out off the fly, he said, it's hard to argue with a life so well lived.
Mm.
Got to hand it to the guy for his response, because the truth of the thing,
sure,
right? You know, Mother Angelica, who founded the largest religious broadcaster in the world, and who was, you know, quite a decent administrator and visionary in Catholic media, right, who we all owe this network to, right? Another great and prominent example. I could go on and on. Father Benedict Groeschel used to tell the joke that he didn't know there were any men in the Church until he went to seminary. Because
wow.
Every Catholic institution he had been involved in was run by women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I work in the chancery, which is the office of the diocese in Birmingham, Alabama. When Bishop Rekha came from Michigan this year, and he met some of my staff and a couple of us guys there, he was like, well, this is kind of interesting. I've been doing, you know, church administration for a while now. I don't usually see this many men around, you know, and women theologians that are on the International Theological Commission even today,
yeah.
Women who are doctors of the Church, theologians, saints, mystics, poets, spiritual writers. I mean, the contribution of women to Catholic life and spirituality is inestimable and unique, and men can't do what they do. And shouldn't try, because it's so amazing. You know, every day I'm turning my thought, my imagination to Teresa of Avila, who is regarded as one of the greatest of the doctors of the interior life, who had a nose for nonsense like nobody you've ever seen.
Yep.
And women often have a nose for nonsense, I've discovered,
you
right?
Bet.
So I agree with her intuition, right? The only error in her reasoning is to think that that's somehow the criterion for the priesthood, that that's what the priesthood is about. Now, every Christian has that call to present Christ and be holy in front of the world, but the priesthood has a very particular vocation, and that is to stand in the place of Christ in sacred liturgy and in a symbolic relationship to the congregation as a husband to a bride and a father to a family. That's his role in the liturgy and in the people of God. Now, you know, you shouldn't criticize maleness as a criterion for priesthood any more than you should criticize maleness as a criterion for fatherhood. Because that's the particular role that it has within the people of God. But there's also a criterion for motherhood in the Catholic faith.
Yeah. So there you go. Ruth, thank you so much for your call. It is called Communion here on EWTN. I want to tell you about a wonderful book now available from EWTN Publishing, A Crisis in Culture, How Secularism is Becoming a Religion, by Father George Rutler. This is a fabulous book. Father Rutler shows how the West's decades-long cultural assault against Christianity is finally reaching its inevitable conclusion, the self-destruction of our culture and against society. This book also talks about why the Catholic faith is the only means by which civilization can be restored. He also talks about the most important virtue for young people today. What do you think that might be? Find out in this great book, available right now at EWTNRC.com. Again, the book is called A Crisis in Culture, How Secularism is Becoming a Religion. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. You won't be sorry. It is a keeper. Here is Marie now on Call to Communion, listening in Omaha on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hey, Marie, what's on your mind today?
Hello. How does the Church discern what apocryphal works, for example, from Origen or other historical writings, say from Josephus? Sometimes the Church uses those in support of its doctrine, and sometimes it's used as, oh, that's apocryphal, we don't put any faith into that, pardon the pun. How does the Church discern which of those are considered valid or truthful?
Okay, yeah, I appreciate the question. So I'm glad you mentioned Origen. Origen is a person of just towering importance in the history of Christian thought and spirituality, who made really inestimable contributions to Catholic life and Catholic thought, and remains sort of wildly popular today among many, including folks like Bishop Barron,
uh-huh.
Big fan of Origen, von Balthasar. Pope Benedict was no mean fan of Origen either. And yet, it's also possible to look back at Origen and say, well, you know, he didn't get it all right. He didn't get it all right. He had some funny ideas. And it's not hard to figure out what the funny ideas were, because the people at the time knew he had funny ideas. And other fathers corrected him. I mean, Jerome is the saint Origen is the guy who had it wrong, who's easiest to like. And Jerome is the guy who had it right, who's easiest to dislike.
Hmm.
You know, he was kind of a cantankerous soul. But Jerome, like, heaped no end of abuse on Origen towards the end of his life for his errors. And, you know, Origen believed in things like apokatastasis, the salvation of the devil and the preexistence of souls, and some crazy stuff like that that he inherited from paganism. And the rest of the Church said, we're not going to go with you there. We're not going there. We like what you do with exegesis. We like your allegorical interpretation of the Bible. We really like your biblical studies. We're not going to follow you into the crazy stuff. And so what the Church has always done is say, look, when the fathers are in agreement with the other fathers and with the deposit of faith and with the rule of faith and the councils of the Church, and they're approved generally and by their antiquity and holiness of life and conformity to the doctrine pronounced in councils, then what they say is sound. Some of them will kind of, you know, get off the rails and go a little bit funny, but that's an outlier, and we just don't pay attention to the outliers.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Marie, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate that. Here is Diana now in Cincinnati, listening on the Great Sacred Heart Radio, a first-time caller. Hi, Diana. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I'm actually calling about a brochure I have, and it was given to me by a friend, and I've since had quite a few friends who have this and have mentioned it. It's the 12-year prayers of St. Bridget on the Passion of Jesus and the sorrows of Mary. And it talks about how for the next four generations your family will be saved from purgatory. And I'm just curious. I mean, I've been saying this every day faithfully, and
okay.
I'm just wondering, is this true?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the point of engaging private revelations like this is to bring about the fruit that it has already inspired in your life, which is to motivate you to a deeper life of prayer. I mean, that's the point of it,
yeah.
Right? Inspired by promises, you're motivated to a deeper life of prayer. There you go. That's the point of it. Now, to interpret it superstitiously, such that by performing a bare ritual, you could somehow guarantee the salvation of future generations without their own free cooperation with grace, well, that would be superstitious, right? But what we do know is that sufficiently deep and charitable prayer does, in fact, have a non-negligible effect on obtaining graces for other individuals with which they can cooperate. And so your prayers can be efficacious in future generations and their life and their sanctity. But again, in a manner that includes their free cooperation. And so there's a superstitious way of understanding these kinds of promises, and then there's a reasonable way of approaching them. And so just take the reasonable way.
There we are. Diana, thank you so much for your call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's Linda now in Federal Way, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio, longtime partner of ours. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about the Pope's statement that has recently come out, and I just need clarification because I go online and I read what different cardinals and bishops have said, and our priest made a statement at church, and I'm still confused and a little bit concerned.
Okay, appreciate the question. So first of all, the Pope didn't make a statement. The Pope didn't make a statement in any kind of official capacity. The brouhaha in the media recently is about something the Pope is alleged to have said in an interview that took place 2 years ago that is being conveniently promulgated in a documentary by an Italian filmmaker short weeks before an American election. Right, so there's a context and spin here that are have not gone unnoticed, but it's not anything like the Pope has somehow come out and made an official pronouncement. I mean, it's just not the case.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is I don't think many of us have seen this Italian film, heard those comments, and certainly hadn't been able to place them in any kind of context. Right, so the long and the short of it is the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, some time ago, has issued an official pronouncement on what the Magisterium and the Catholic Church's position is on civil unions for homosexual couples, and it's that they should be disallowed. That's the position the congregation has taken historically on this issue, right? And an off-the-cuff statement alleged to have been made in a documentary 2 years ago doesn't change that and couldn't, right? So you don't really have to pay much attention to it, except that this is a kind of propaganda free-for-all to manipulate people and consciences in ways that strike me as grossly unreasonable.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. Here is Joan in Jacksonville, Florida, listening on EWTN television. Joan, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I'm trying to find out. I heard you earlier tell somebody that as far as participating formally in the baptism of someone else, you could not do. But what about informally when you are invited to go to a relative's wedding and they are marrying, they're Catholic, they've been raised in the church, and they are marrying outside the church, in another Christian denomination, and they have agreed to raise the children in that denomination. And I've had my Catholic friends say, well, you should go. You're not formally, you know, okaying this. You're just going as a, you know, in support of them. And I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't make myself go. What is the position on that?
Right. Well, you followed your conscience, and that's the position on that. Right. You followed your conscience, and that's the position on that. I think that you know, to say categorically that a Catholic should absolutely, under no circumstances, ever attend this kind of wedding would be a little bit farther than I'd be comfortable going.
Mm-hmm.
But we know there are certain things that you absolutely can't do. You can't formally cooperate in evil, right? So you couldn't participate in any way that signaled or your actual intent or desire that this union be celebrated, because you'd be consenting to something intrinsically evil,
mm-hmm.
right? If you give the impression that you so consent, which is not the same thing as consenting,
mm-hmm.
you would risk scandal, namely letting the people around you think that you thought that it was okay, right? And mm-hmm. so that's a question you have to prudentially judge. Would my participation in this be an occasion of scandal? And that would be magnified, you know, if, for example, there were younger people around who looked to you as a kind of an authority on the Catholic faith. And,
uh-huh.
well, you know, Aunt Joan thinks it's okay. She thinks it's okay. must be okay. Well, that'd be scandal. And Jesus has some harsh words about those people that call scandal. So there you go.
So there we go.
And the music cut me off.
Joan, thank you so much for your call. As we're rolling out the door here, Anne in St. Augustine, Florida wanted to know, was Mark the author of Mark?
It's a good question. The only way you'll know, the only way you could know that is from sacred tradition. Because the Bible doesn't say.
Okay. There you go, and do check that out. Dr. David Anders, a fast-moving show. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, we do the program Monday through Friday here on EWTN Radio, 2 p.m. Eastern, with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern, and a best-of Call to Communion Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. On behalf of our fantastic crew, and that would be Ryan and Charles and Jeff, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.